kids gather in Sana'a to denounce the UN over its move to add Dancer La Movement to its black list of parties violating children's rights. Russia reports 546 new deaths from the coronavirus, marking the most confirmed fatalities in a single day since February. And the influential sister of the North Korean leader says that the U.S.'s expectations on talks with Pyongyang will only bring greater disappointment to Washington. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Yemenis have filled the streets in the capital to denounce UN allegations against the country's Ansar La movement. Children and adults joined the rally in Sana'a. They protested a Friday decision by the UN chief, Antonio Guterres, to add Ansarullah to blacklist of groups for violating children's rights. Protesters condemned the UN for its silence on the killing of the Yemeni children by Saudi Arabia and its allies. Children have been among tens of thousands of civilians who've been killed in the Saudi war on Yemen. The war began in March 2015. It has caused a dire humanitarian situation that has taken a heavy toll on Yemeni kids. The Israeli army has targeted the Gaza Strip's infrastructure, including its main water treatment station. This contaminated Gaza's water resources with untreated sewage, putting at risk the health of nearly 2 million Palestinians in an impoverished enclave. Ruba Shabit has more from Gaza.
Israeli forces carried out a full-scale military offensive against the Gaza Strip, targeting civilian areas and infrastructure in a clear violation of international humanitarian law. During this attack, Israel damaged paved roads and other infrastructure, including Gaza sewage treatment stations and networks. 18 sewage water pumps were damaged, and Gaza central sewage treatment stations were unable to function as employees were unable to go to their workplace due to the intensity of the situation.
The Israeli regime destroyed most infrastructure in Gaza. Sewage treatment stations were among the targets of the Israeli regime, where one of our main stations was completely destroyed and the rest are partially damaged. Israeli airstrikes also damaged the electricity network that generates the treatment stations. This has polluted the sea with untreated sewage.
The Gaza Electricity Distribution Company recently announced that its power supply services will be intermittent due to the lack of fuel used to generate electricity caused by Israel's ban of entering fuel. With the limited capacity of power supply due to the Israeli airstrikes of electricity networks, sewage water is directly treated into the sea. As a result, nearly 2 million Palestinians in Gaza now face a serious public health emergency.
There is a huge damage in the electricity network of the Gaza Strip. Electricity turned into a problem for Gazans since 2006, when Israeli regime destroyed the only electricity plant. Since then, all aspects of our lives have been negatively impacted. The electricity condition is terrible due to the Israeli blockade that prevents entering fuel.
In Palestinian refugee camps, the condition is even worse, where residents of the camp are suffering the shortage of clean water and bad health conditions since the Israeli blockade was imposed for more than 15 years. This led to the increase of diseases among the residents.
This is a terrible condition here. We are left without water and electricity. We are stuck at home because Israel targets any moving thing. There isn't any water for drinking, cleaning, or any other purposes. Israel intends to target our infrastructure and the water station as a punishment for all Gazans.
In addition to the Israeli blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip for about 15 years, the continuous violence against civilians and infrastructure has increased the suffering of 2 million Palestinians and undermined their rights of living and health. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Russia has recorded 546 new deaths from COVID-19. That is the country's highest figure of daily deaths since February. The government's coronavirus task force also reported over 16,000 new infections in the past 24 hours. More than a third of them were registered in the capital, Moscow. The new figures raise Russia's national caseload to more than 5.3 million, and its overall deaths to above 130,000. The country has been witnessing a surge in new COVID cases over the past days. Authorities have blamed the surge on the Delta variant that was first seen in India. Well, in India, 24-hour new coronavirus cases have reached their lowest level in nearly 3 months. The country on Tuesday reported more than 42,600 new infections and almost 1,200 new fatalities. India's total caseload is now nearing 30 million. Its death toll has passed 389,000. The country witnessed a surge in the disease in April and in May that caused a health crisis there. Daily infections reached a peak of more than 400,000 last month. Now, new cases have kept a declining trend over the past couple of weeks. That follows strict lockdowns and mass vaccine rollouts. The World Health Organization has warned about a lack of supply of coronavirus vaccines to poorer countries. It says that more than half of these countries receiving COVID-19 vaccines via the COVAX program don't have enough supplies to continue inoculations. We discuss the matter with our guests. Let's take a listen.
Segments. The World Health Organization says more than half of poorer countries receiving COVID-19 vaccines via the COVAX program don't have enough supplies to continue inoculations. A senior WHO advisor said over 40 nations are estimated to have hit a vaccine shortage, with some having completely run out of doses. He added that the actual number might be even higher. The shortages are partly due to production delays and disruptions in vaccine supply from India. This comes as coronavirus infections and related deaths have been on the rise across Africa. Joining us is Julius Valuto, a political analyst from London, and also Ian Williams, senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus from New York. Gentlemen, welcome. Julius, you know, when we take a look at this situation we have around the world, let's take, for example, the United States. It's got more supplies of COVID than it needs. It sent them recently to Taiwan. It could have sent that to Africa, for example.
The truth of the matter is that Africa is not really experiencing great support from the West. Unfortunately, it's just a few countries in the Western Hemisphere, we're talking also about America, that have been given like the right to make this medication, with understanding that they were supposed to, in a very equitable manner, share these out through the World Health Organization via COVAX mechanism to many countries in Africa. But unfortunately, very few doses have found their way to Africa. And whenever they do, although we are talking about the delays, as in terms of from the production process, because like countries in Britain, US, most of them pre-ordered a lot before the production. So even when the production finishes, you find out that it just comes to these few countries, but never goes to Africa. So there's a delay on that front. But also the one that is supposed to be taken to Africa on the ground via COVAX, some of them found their way in Africa with a very short shelf life. To give you an example, for example, in Malawi, they had to ban 20,000 jabs from AstraZeneca. South Sudan as well had to give back 72,000 doses of the same because they were almost out of date. And the conversation was right. Like, you can still have them. How do you have something? Is that run out of date?
Out of date, you can't use it anymore. Ian, welcome. What's your take on this? I mean, if we take Britain, the UK, for example, started well with this inoculation program, inoculated the majority of its population. But doesn't the UK government realize that its economy relies on, you know, let's say herd immunity, for example, global herd immunity. If Britain wants to restore its economy back to where it was to pre-COVID levels, then surely it needs to put its share into the COVAX program, because the Delta, if I'm not mistaken, the Delta virus, that came from India, and people come in and out, and that's how economies work.
Well, I mean, what the British government leads needs and is showing the world how an incompetent government can cause huge medical tragedies. I think we're seeing that in India as well as Britain. And India is failing to deliver to the rest of the world because it's got its own manifest problems. I mean, even the production of the vaccines has been hit by the scale of the epidemic there. Governments knew that this was coming. A lot of them just got the Trump gestalt and thought to themselves, it's just a bit of flu, really, until the bodies started piling up. And then they panicked and started racing out. And, some of them have excuses. They don't have the money to buy the vaccines. Some of the vaccines were offered for free. India actually has a substantial pharmaceutical base because it defies the World Trade Organization and other people on intellectual property rights. It says if there's medicine, we can make it. We don't care which patents you hold, which is a commendable attitude. It's one of the reasons why they had a solid base to become one of the world's manufacturers of this. But obviously, they didn't gear up. The epidemic is taking over everyone. Yes, Western governments could and should do more, but it's a hard decision. How do you tell your voters that their friends and relatives are going to die because we're sending the vaccine somewhere else?
In the case of the
doing it is
in the case of the UK, in the case of the UK, Ian, they didn't have to inoculate the people with no underlying health conditions, and the teenagers, which they are doing now. They could send those extra doses from a humanitarian point of view to the COVAX program. As I said, the Delta, because now they're talking about another wave in the UK. The Delta came from India, which means it came from abroad. So if it wants to recoup its economy back to where it was, it has to inoculate the entire world.
Yes, it has to, and it should do, but it comes down to priorities. I'm not certainly not defending Boris Johnson's government in any particulars, but here in New York, they're inoculating 12-year-olds now, and that was because New York suffered extremely badly. And one of the points about this is it's not just people catching, dying of COVID; it's people passing it on to others. We're talking about building up immunity. You have to get a huge penetration of vaccines into the population before it stops being transmitted. I mean, I've been vaccinated. I don't know whether that protects whether it protects me from infection or not. But if I go around sneezing on people, if a 16-year-old has asymptomatic COVID, he can still pass on the virus, and that's the danger. So there's a tendency for people to assume that maximum vaccination is the best answer, unless, of course, you read the internet, where there are lots of people who seem to think that vaccinations are killing people. One of the problems in India is a lot of people are refusing the vaccine when it is
take
available.
The vaccine, right. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Let's thank our guest, Julius Balutu, political analyst joining us from London. Ian Williams, as always, senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, joining us out of New York. And that brings an end to this edition of the News Review.
Welcome back. The sister of North Korea's leader has mocked American hopes for an early resumption of negotiations for denuclearization of her country. Kim Yo-jong says that the U.S. appears to be interpreting signals from North Korea in a way to seek a comfort for itself. She says the U.S. has wrong expectations that will only bring a greater disappointment for Washington. Kim Yo-jong is a key advisor to the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Last week, Kim said that Pyongyang must prepare for both dialogue and confrontation with Washington. The U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan described the comment as an interesting signal. Previous bilateral talks have failed on North Korea's denuclearization, returned for U.S. sanctions relief. Jennifer Chang says that North Korea is demanding tangible concessions from the U.S. to agree to fresh talks.
Not much was said by her in detail, but analysts say that the major stumbling block is the upcoming U.S.-South Korea joint military drills in August. The U.S. and South Korea have two such drills, one in March and one in August. And the one in August is seen as a hostile policy by North Korea. Until the South Korea drop these drills, the North Koreans are unwilling to come to the bargaining table, they say. Now, the North Koreans are not shutting the door to dialogue, but just offering talks without preconditions will not be enough. They actually have to offer more incentives to North Korea, like doing away with these military drills. Already, the U.S. and South Korea are looking into the possibility of scaling back these drills, but that probably won't be enough. The North Korean leader's sister is saying the U.S. is going to be disappointed in thinking that the North will come back to the negotiating table. It is not going to do that until the U.S. does more compromising and actually offers something tangible.
The European Union and a number of Western countries have imposed a new wave of sanctions on Belarus over the alleged forced landing of an airliner last month.
We have adopted today, with respect to Belarus, the largest package of sanctions, listing 86 individuals and entities, and in particular targeting those behind the hijacking of the plane with Mr. Pratasevich on board. These measures were coordinated also with Canada, UK, and US.
Borrell made the comment following a meeting of EU foreign ministers in Luxembourg. The German foreign minister, Heiko Maas, also said the new sanctions aim to severely hit key sectors of the Belarusian economy. Separately, Britain, Canada, and the US slapped sanctions on dozens of Belarusian officials and firms, citing human rights abuses and the erosion of democracy. The West accuses Minsk of diverting a passenger plane last month while it was traveling between two EU capitals to arrest the dissidents on board. Belarus denies the accusations, saying that the airliner was ordered to land over a security threat. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, directed by Oscar-nominated filmmaker Steve James. And joining me in the studio, we have Matthew Turner, who's a freelance film critic who writes for Godzilla, iNews, and The List, among various other publications. And sitting next to him, we are also joined by political economist Clive Menzies, who is involved in Critical Thinking, a research and educational project which seeks to understand how the political economy works and identify levers for change. Now, this documentary centers on the Abacus Federal Savings Bank, a small American Chinese-owned family bank situated in Manhattan's Chinatown in New York City, which, because it was deemed small enough to jail rather than too big to fail, became the only financial institution to actually face criminal charges following the mortgage crisis in 2008. And born in Shanghai, Thomas Song founded Abacus Federal in 1984, hoping to make it easier for Chinese immigrants to get loans. And the bank eventually became a community hub, but in 2012, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office charged it with mortgage fraud, also indicting 19 of its former employees. And this film shows the Sun family fighting back against the charges and the toll it takes on them, as well as the Chinese community.
Today, we are
announcing the indictment of the Federal Savings Bank on mortgage fraud, securities fraud, and conspiracy. A federally chartered bank that has been catering to the Chinese immigrant community since 1984.
If you are going to pick on a bank, a family-owned company, wedged between a couple of noodle shops in Chinatown, is about as easy a target as you could possibly pick.
When I was a lawyer, there was no bank owned by Chinese and serving the Chinese. When I walk around here, I feel very much at home. This is a very tasty noodle shop.
That's always special. That's the butt.
When we were children, my dad was excited about this bank he was going to start.
We serve people who've never even dealt with the banking system before.
This whole ordeal began in 2009.
One of our loan officers stole money.
He was lying all over the place.
He was running a money laundering operation. I fired him that day.
They went straight to their regulator, and they told them about it.
The DA's office started asking us questions.
Wait a minute. Maybe we're the target.
If that prosecution goes through, that bank is going to go out of business.
Although this is David versus Goliath, they're a whole family of lawyers.
We spent a lot of time investigating and ended up absolutely convinced that the loan department was corrupt through and through.
They routinely falsified mortgage documents.
Reporters in this town were treated to this extraordinary photo opportunity. This almost Stalinist-looking chain gang
herded like cattle down the hallway. I've been doing this for 25 years, and I'd never seen that happen.
Mommy's worried. Papa's 80 years old. He's been up since 5:30 a.m. and he has nothing to eat for dinner. Let's get you some food. Papa, you do.
This is how he is. He's very calm, and I'm like a jumping bean, so I'm always running around.
You're going to eat now. You're older than a man, okay?
Federal Savings Bank had one of the nation's lowest default rates, not the highest, one of the lowest. Frankly, if every bank had underwritten as well as Abacus, we wouldn't have had a financial crisis.
People get the wrong impression that Chinese are not law-abiding.
This case is an attack on our community. We're easy prey.
Too big to fail turns into small enough to jail, and Abacus is small enough to jail.
Very well and welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary, I think, gives a refreshing look at the banking crisis in that, unlike many documentaries and films in this subject, we get to see the more personal stories and the social impact the crash had. Now, Matthew, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Abacus Small Enough to Jail?
Well, one of the most interesting things about it is we're used to seeing the big guy versus little guy stories, but the big guy is usually the bank. In this case, the little guy is the bank, and that sort of perspective, that sort of family-oriented perspective of it, is very interesting. I really enjoyed the film. I thought it was a strong story. Like, you care deeply about the family and get to know them very well. The director, as you said, he made Hoop Dreams, and he made the Roger Ebert documentary Life Itself, and he's very good at those sort of small, intimate family stories. And it's a very effective story, very, very well told. The court case stuff is interesting, if not perhaps quite as dramatic as you're maybe expecting. I mean, I don't think the outcome of the film is particularly in doubt, but it's still a very enjoyable, you know, piece to watch.
And Clive, if I could turn to you, what was your take on the film? Would you agree with what Matthew said?
Yeah, I think it was a very good film as a story of itself. And I think they gave enough suggestion of this too big to fail versus small enough to jail. But to actually do that whole story justice is really two films, and maybe something like The Big Short and this together actually show you more of the picture.
And what did you make of Matthew's point that this dynamic between sort of the big guy not being the bank in this case, but the small guy?
Well, arguably, the banks control the regulatory system anyway, so it's not really surprising. And our analysis would suggest that this was a targeted attempt to show that they were doing something about the crisis whilst quite willfully ignoring egregious crimes on a much larger scale.
And Matthew, as you were saying, you said that Steve James is good at telling personal family stories. In this documentary, though, it's quite politically charged. Do you think he was making a political statement?
I don't think he was trying to. I mean, you have the press conferences and that Cyrus Vance, the DA, gives, where he's very sort of explicitly targeting the banks, whereas actually the reality is it's a very small bank and nothing really related to what you call Wall Street. And you have the quite extraordinary the scene we just saw in the clip there with the chain gang, which is just really shocking anyway. And everybody interviewed in the film says that they've been working in this business 25 years or more and they've never seen anything like that. And the implication is they would never have done that to white bankers, black bankers, you know, anything like that.
Exonerating our entire community, no matter what we do, be it the little guy selling vegetables or a bank that's doing business. I told Mr. Song, I'm glad they pick on you because you're a fighter.
Cyrus Vance just felt this is easier to attack, especially as a family bank. But he doesn't realize Tom is not easy to be pushed around. And my girls, they're tough, smart, capable women, so courageous.
Although this is David versus Goliath, David being Advocates Federal Savings Bank has a slingshot. And that is, you know, their whole family of lawyers.
I was going to be able to fight this. They're almost gleeful. They're like, we're going to have our day in court now. We're actually going to be able to show that they were wrong.
They made a decision that they were not going to plead guilty to something that they didn't feel the bank was guilty of. That is a courageous choice, and it's an expensive choice. The DA's office has hundreds of lawyers and took 5 years to do their grand jury investigations, and it is a daunting task to fight the government.
You could feel the enormous weight on their shoulders and the sort of stacks that are against them. Matthew, what did you make of their efforts of the Sung family to fight back?
Well, the filmmaker Steve James picks up the. I guess he's come on board the story somewhere after the court case begins and but before the result of the trial. So the cameras are actually there when the verdicts come in you get a lot of the. You're not obviously allowed cameras inside the courtroom, but there's a lot of court reconstruction, so you have a feel for how the toll that the trial itself is taking on them. And yeah, I mean, as that clip showed, they're very sort of feisty characters, and they're all three of the women are lawyers, and they're really, yeah, they're very hungry for the fight, if you like. You don't really get a sense of how the investigation is going from the other side. You only see them and their efforts to sort of fight back and what they're doing as a family. You don't really get a sense of the DA's office. There are a couple of interviews with people who are involved in the DA's office, but they don't really tell you anything of great interest. Mm-hmm.
And Clive, would you agree? What did you make of the Sung's family challenges and their struggle to fight back against the DA? Do you think they were justified?
They were certainly justified. I suspect the DA were quite surprised at the strength of their fight back, because I think the Chinese community, or Chinese as a culture, are generally quite diffident and respectful of authority. And I think they hoped to actually ship them into pleading guilty, and they failed.
I mean, absolutely, there is a clip where Tom Sung, basically, he's offered a plea deal, and then he says, no, I'm not going to take that plea deal. And it's really obvious that the DA's department thought they would just take that plea deal and, you know, all their problems would just magically go away. But no, they don't take the deal, exactly. And, I mean, as you say, it cost them $10 million, so another smaller business maybe wouldn't have been able to fight that the way they did.
And Clive, why was it then that, as the film claims, that Abacus was the only financial institution to actually face criminal charges following the 2008 financial crisis? You know, why don't we hear about major firms like Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, or Countrywide being held to account?
Could you imagine the outrage if you had Jewish bankers chained like they chained those employees? There's a very simple reason. The fraud that they're talking about in this film is nothing to do with the subprime crisis in terms of what crimes were actually committed, because the loan default rate on the Fannie Mae loans, the injured party was supposed to be Fannie Mae, who made a lot of money out of this bank's loan book. And there were 9 defaults out of 3,000 mortgages. And actually, as it says in the film, their loan history was infinitely better than anyone else. What was happening in the subprime crisis is that people were packaging up garbage and selling it. There are stories of senior managers in Standard & Poor's, the credit rating agencies, being shouted at, being told to rate stuff, even though they didn't have the files on which to rate it. So there was this huge fraud, this creation of an illusion of some sort of quality in a mortgage book that was full of holes, unlike Abacus Bank, which had really well-documented loans. Yes,
they had a case of a bad apple, but they fired the man who was giving out
there is
bad
obviously
loans.
A cultural element to this case, which is debt is as a construct, is a social construct in a community. If I'm related to you and I lend you money, whether you pay me back is much less important than if I've signed a piece of paper with someone. And that is a culture of this community. And you could argue that there was fraudulent documentation, but it wasn't obscuring what was actually going on in the way it was going on in the subprime crisis, where people who were never going to be able to pay it, they didn't have cash earnings on the side that they weren't declaring. They were never going to be able to repay these loans. And the people selling those mortgages knew that, and they bet against their clients at the same time. So the criminality of the system, which controls most of the regulation as well, is actually trying to use this little bank as some sort of flag waving that we're jailing bankers. The only country to jail bankers was Iceland, and they jailed 28. Every other country capitulated. And this case had nothing to do with the subprime crisis.
I'm a former prosecutor. I'm not soft on crime. I've never seen a spectacle like this. These people were humiliated intentionally for no good reason.
It is not the district attorney's office's decision whether or not to put people in handcuffs, but people who were brought into court who have been charged with crimes are put into handcuffs. That's a decision that's made by the court officers. I won't go into it more than that because, you know, it's not something I'm involved with.
So in the film, we learn that the Abacus Bank plays an important role in the Chinese community. And we also find that it provides mortgages to immigrants who live sort of in a cash economy and have hidden assets. And we also learn more about Thomas Sung and his character in this film and his intentions, his noble intentions in starting the bank, as he believes that Chinese immigrants were being left out of the American dream. And what did you make of his character and his story?
Well, and the film explicitly uses clips from Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life. The opening shot of the movie is Thomas Sung and his wife watching it and identifying very strongly with James Stewart's character, George Bailey, and particularly his position within the sort of small-town community, what feels like a small-town community, and helping people with small businesses, and he knows all the businesses, everybody knows who he is, and stuff like that. So there is very much that sort of man of the people element to Thomas Sung's story, I think.
And there's a scene in the documentary where we see that he's able to calm the crowds of all the clients who are rushing to get their money back, and he's able to soothe them.
Exactly like happens in It's a Wonderful Life. And in fact, the film shows clips of that exact same scene happening. It shows clips of George Bailey speaking to the crowd, preventing the run on the bank by telling them that your money's in his business and your money's in his business, and everybody's kind of helping each other. And you don't actually see Sung calming his own crowd, but he tells you have him telling the audience what he actually did, which is basically exactly the same thing. He went out and told everyone, calm down, you know, trust me, you know me, I'm here, you know, your money's safe, and it works. And
it was an
incredible
moment.
Scene, actually.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And Clive, the film shows and suggests that there were racial implications behind the charges. Why were they being singled out? Was it because they were Chinese?
I don't think it was racist in the sense that the Chinese are dishonest. I think it was the Chinese were seen as a soft touch. As Matthew said, you know, that they were visibly shocked when they wouldn't cave and plead for guilty. Mm-hmm. They preferred to fight. And I think that was their undoing. Other than that, I don't think it was racist as such as demonizing their community, but clearly it had that effect. And it's interesting, Matthew talked about It's a Wonderful Life, and banking is an inherently dishonest business, which I won't go into. But what has been banking's salvation over the years is the relationships, and that's what banking always used to be based on. but that has completely gone with these mega banks. So there is no relationship. So you are dependent on the forms, whereas in a bank like Abacus, you're dependent on the relationships, and that's what their business is. And that's in stark contrast to what was going on elsewhere and being ignored.
That's a really interesting point. Did you want to add anything to that, Matthew?
There was, on the racism element, there is a very telling comment from, I think it's the DA, correct me if I'm wrong, but where he says, oh, well, no, of course we weren't racist. We didn't treat them any differently to the way we treat South American bankers or, you know, Russian bankers or, you know, he sort of lists another,
other ethnic groups,
yeah, but leaves one kind of fairly major group out, white bankers, and that's the kind of fairness you'd at least expect.
I never thought my girls would work in Chinatown because we lived in Greenwich, Connecticut. Tom would be commuting every day, you know, like an hour and a half each way. So he didn't see them that much in those days. They had no idea, anything, not a faintest idea about the Chinese community. In fact, Heather still does. She hates the city, you know. She's like me, we both have headaches. And at home, when we don't want them to understand, we speak Chinese.
You always said to me, if you come work for the bank, the benefit will be you have a 9-to-4 job.
9-to-4?
Yeah, because a long time ago, people could leave at 3 for the bank. He said, you can have children, you can have a family.
You know what he said to me? He said, if you wish to work with me, remember, this is your own choice. And don't think it's going to be easy. You gave me two different stories.
They're very endearing, warm family, and it makes you wonder, I wonder if any other bank CEOs are this caring. Matthew, I just wanted to ask for your brief views on the family themselves and how they're portrayed.
I think they're great. I mean, they're very entertaining dynamic between certainly the daughters and the mother. The mother's the real star of the movie, in my opinion, and she's sort of undercuts all of them with quite sort of funny comments. There's a whole sequence, a whole bizarre sequence where they're all sort of stressing about the sandwich that the father is eating and whether it's too dry and is he enjoying it and is he sure he's enjoying it and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, you get a
real feel. But then it highlights the unfairness of the situation, that there's an old man enduring this ordeal.
Yeah, he's 80. He's 75 when the prosecution begins and he's 80 when it finishes. Although I have to say, he looks pretty damn good for 80.
Yeah, not bad at all. And Clive, I'd like to talk about the wider issues now of the film. Why isn't there, I get the sense of this theme in the film, that there's a lack of accountability in the banking world. What do you make of this?
If you look at the personalities and the structures, they're all related. So the banks, in effect, control the central banks, they control the regulators, and so what appears to be wrongdoing can always be covered up. So you take the example of HSBC money laundering. They confessed. So the Department of Justice had a cast iron case. They were lent on by a combination of George Osborne, Adair Turner, and Mark Carney. Chancellor of the Bank of England, head of the FSA at the time, and Chancellor of the Exchequer. They all sit on the Bank of International Settlements Board. So there is this web of power that sits over the financial system that actually ensures its own survival. That's why they bullied Congress into bailing out the banks in 2008, because they control
the power. And we saw this in our
country
as well. Why is there such a tight relationship between the banks and the government? Aren't the banks supposed to serve the people?
Well, it comes back to that Rothschild quote, that let me control the nation's money supply, and I care not about its laws. Simply money gives you control, particularly when you can create that money from nothing. So you can buy politicians, you can bribe politicians, you can pay people to kill politicians. So what's a politician got to do? He's got to obey orders.
There's some very hot issues you raise. But does this film evoke these sort of wider questions and raise issues about the morality of banking? Did you get that sense also from watching the documentary?
In this particular story, it's more focused on this small family and their small bank, and how, as Clive said, that this what happens to the Sun family is not related to the wider financial crisis. It's not the same, you know, the same thing. So in that sense, no. But you are very much aware of the financial crisis in the background, and certainly, like I said, the press conference that Cyrus Vance gives, where he gives this very sort of ebullient statement about, well, yes, we're going to be jailing these bank effect. Well, words to the effect of, we're going to be jailing these bankers, without really going into the detail. Yeah, certainly that's there.
But certainly we learn that they emerge victoriously from this, the Sung family.
Yes,
a little spoiler, but I think it's public knowledge sort of now that this court case has gone on. But just final thoughts now. Matthew, what's your verdict on this film and would you recommend it?
I would certainly recommend it. It's a very entertaining story. But it makes you angry a little bit and it's always interesting to see film documentaries where there's a strong sense of injustice, and particularly if it ends well, then that's all for the better. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it certainly.
And final thoughts to you also, Clive, would you recommend this documentary?
I certainly would. What spoke volumes to me is that Ken Yu, the DA star witness, was the original fraudster that was reported by the bank to the authorities, and they revoked his plea bargain at the end and charged him. And so, that tells you exactly what was going on.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but just quickly.
I just wanted to add to that, actually, that really stuck out for me as well. Like, not only that, the original fraudster becomes the prosecution's star witness, which is just insane. I really couldn't understand that at all, like how that was allowed to happen. Basically, somebody who has confessed to lying and been caught lying and committing fraud becomes the star witness. Mm-hmm.
It's a very puzzling business indeed, but I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. And we've come to the end of this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
سید عبدالله الموسوی.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. In the previous episodes, we were merely trying to have a quick look at how Islam looks at and establishes peace, justice, equality, and basic human rights for its citizens and for the citizens in general, for all human beings, compared to other religions. And specifically, we looked at Judaism, where the concept of a human rights, it does not exist, not unless you're a Jew yourself. And we said, obviously, that's not the actual religion of Musa, alayhi salam. This is the fabricated version of it that the rabbis have brought forward in order to have dominance and control over people. So when it comes to Islam, Islam says no, everything needs to be preserved, the right needs to be preserved, every aspect of human life needs to be preserved. While in other religions, you don't see that. So when we, for example, when we look at Judaism, and why would we say Judaism? Because a lot of people and a lot of systems in the world now give their Jews and give their respect to Judaism, especially, for example, if you look at Western powers, America, England, and other countries. So Judaism to them, or the Jews, or, you know, the land that is occupied, the occupied land, to them is a holy grail. It's a holy system. It's not just a matter of, you know, saying Judaism, well, it's a religion. No, to them, it's a code. So when the West, for example, as you can see the trend, that every time a president gets elected in America, the first thing he has to do is he has to go to Palestine, and he has to go to the Wailing Wall, and he has to give his respect. Otherwise, he won't be in power for too long. So it is not just a system that, you know, it's a religious system, but in fact it's got control over the world. So since it's got control over the world, it means what? It means they can dictate and break the human right charter to meet their needs. So many wars, and for example, if you look at Palestine, for example, as a country, the humans and the people and the citizens who live in Palestine, the landowners, they have no right over anything. For God's sake, they don't even have right over their houses. The Jews, they could walk any day, take their house away from them, demolish the house, and say, okay, off you go, find yourself another place. Now, where does that fit in the human rights charter that says, you know, its first article is that everyone has a right to be free and everyone was born free? What does that fit? Which means that they had so much influence that this system that they have, this textbook that they have, the Old Testament and the religion they formulated, it is so powerful, so strong, that they could even twist the arms of the United Nations and the arms of the Western powers. That I can defy, I can break any human rights as I see fit, and there's nothing you can do about it. Now, you tell me, isn't that terrorist at its best form or not? And so we have to be very careful not to assume or associate that to Musa alayhi salam. So the concept of human rights, when you compare it to Islam, to Karen Judaism, there's a massive difference, where Islam says you have no right if you are a state, if you are an Islamic state, let's say, and you have government, as we see in other, you know, in the Middle East. It says you are not to go invade and harm other people, or, for example, even try to harm your own citizens by taking their possessions, as we see happening in Palestine, under the pretext that it is the land of the Jews, which is absolute nonsensical. Now, stay with me. Let's take a break and we'll come back, inshallah.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. So before, we were saying that looking at religions and comparing them to Islam and how they differ. And we said in Islam, it's based on the fact that it needs to preserve the human rights, and other religions are based on the fact that human rights only applies to me. Everyone else needs to find another place to live. So this is when we talk about, for example, we look at Judaism. When we look at Christianity is a very interesting religion itself, if we can call them religion, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not refer to them as deen. He refers to them as shara'a, which is just a way of life rather than actual religion. So the sharia of Isa alayhi salam, for example, it was in its nature, it is very peaceful. It does not get involved in the politics of things. It does not get in too much things, even though you might find hints here and there where it might seem a bit, you know, out of whack, as we say, only because it is out of whack. Because the same people that misinterpreted and they fabricated the Torah, the Old Testament, they done the exact same thing to the Injil and the Bible of Isa alayhi salam, or as we call him, Jesus. So the same thing. Even though what happened is that after Isa alayhi salam, after 100 years, when Paulus came through and he said he acclaimed that he saw Isa, and you know, he initiated Christianity as we know it today, they also established states, borders, passports, and so on and so forth. And they gave themselves also an authority, which they called the Pope. And then we had the problem as well. Because, as we said, religions and prophets meant to be peaceful. They came to establish human rights, not to take human rights. So when the Pope, the new Pope took place and the new church was formed, they were oppressors themselves as well. Where, for example, if you go against them, you will be hanged. And you can go back to history and see how many scientists that they hanged, like Galileo and of the like, and how many scholars that they've hanged because they went against them, and so on and so forth. So the church itself became tyrannic, and they acclaimed that they're doing this under the by the name of God, and you know, by the blessings of Isa alayhi salam himself, God forbid. So even that, even Christianity itself, when it formed as a church or as a nation, it was formed on the base of power, and on the base that you either with me or you're against me. And then you have the Crusaders and the Crusade Wars, and that, which is a long topic I don't want to get into. And you see how bloodthirsty those Crusaders were when they came to the Arabic peninsula, under the Arabic world, and when they came to Palestine, under the fact that it is their right, God-given right. And you see that human rights does not exist in their charter either. Only Islam looks at the human right and gives it to them, and tries to elevate humans all together, regardless of their faith and regardless of their religion. So only Islam prevails, only Islam is successful and victorious when it comes to giving people their rights. Inshallah, we will continue in episodes to come. Stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin. Ya Rabbi salli ala Muhammadin wa ali. Ya Rabbi salli.
from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.